Now it was time to move on from the lively world of Caltech into my own academic position. Before settling into that life, I was off to Italy to train with Berlucci. We had an idea, one so painfully simple and naive that it cracks us up to even think about it today. The reasoning went like this. Colossum intact persons can name objects and words in each visual field. Speech is only in the left brain. That means stimuli presented to the right hemisphere by flashing in the left visual field had to somehow transfer over the colossum to the left hemisphere in order to be expressed. By recording in the corpus callosum, we could figure out the brain code. It would be like the Morse code of the brain or something cool like that. Now, there are lots of reasons to go to Italy, science being only one of them. I have often thought the world should simply turn Italy into something like a national park for the world to enjoy. It is simply stunning. Deep, loaded with history, art, and fun. Delicious, crazy, breathtaking, irreverent, and hilarious. 45 years ago, I was about to learn all of this from my first experience in Pisa. My wife, my 2-year-old daughter, Marin, and I were driving down from Paris in a small VW Bug and were going to arrive in Pisa very late, around 2 a.m. It was dark, windy, and raining as I sped down the highway. Things were looking pretty bleak and were about to get bleaker. I saw the flashing red lights of the Carabinieri in my rearview mirror signaling me to pull over. My heart sank as the officer approached the car. I didn't speak Italian, he didn't speak English. After an exchange of stern pleasantries, he asked for my license and passaporto. None of these documents produced a change in the stern expression on his face. He then, as best I could figure out, asked me what we were doing in Italy. I think I figured this out because I heard the word turista in there somewhere. Luckily, I had a letter from Giuseppe Maruzzi, the famous Italian neurophysiologist who ran the Instituto di Fisiologia in Pisa. I fished it out and handed it to him. He took it with some disdain and focused his flashlight on it. As he read it, and before my very eyes, he was transformed into a highly respectful servant of the public. Mi scusa, professore. I didn't see any reason to correct him on my lowly academic status. Before I knew it, we were on our way with no problems and no citation. I probably could have had an escort if I'd known how to ask. The police respect professors? Wow. I knew then that I loved Italy, my genetic home. Once settled into a beautiful apartment that had been arranged for us to rent, I was off to work at the Istituto, a beautiful building only a few blocks from our apartment. No room was available in the main building to set up a lab, so Giovanni arranged for us to use a spare building situated in the garden. So there we were. We had some kind of idea and an empty room. It was time to go to work. Also at the Istituto was Giacomo Rizzolatti, a young neurophysiologist of enormous talent, who later went on to discover mirror neurons, the group of neurons we all possess that track the actions of others. Giacomo and Giovanni were to become very close friends. Both were superior neurophysiologists, and they were going to try to teach me the trade. It would be a whole new world, a different kind of biology, a time-consuming, demanding, and exacting skill. First, however, we needed to set up for the experiments. In general terms, we needed an operating platform, recording equipment, a projector, a screen, and cats. Berlucci decided we needed a special screen, a half-dome kind of thing, so as the cat gazed ahead, every point on the screen would be equidistant from its eyes. A metal welder in town made stuff, all kinds of stuff, but I can assure you he had never made a half-dome out of bent steel for a cat to gaze upon. He seemed game, however, when Berlucci explained the project, and although a bit disbelieving, built a half-dome. It was delivered on a trailer, drawn behind one of those little scooter trucks you see all over Italy. As it approached, everybody started to laugh. We had a problem. It was too big to get through the door into the lab. Unperturbed, Giovanni declared, "Non c'è problema." He ordered the dome cut in half in such a way that it could be bolted back together once the pieces were inside the room. It got done. Meanwhile, Pasquale, the lab animal technician, found cats for us. Oh, how things were different in those days. Cats did not come from some highly regulated biomedical animal provider, as they have now for at least 30 years. Cats came from the alley. It was Pasquale's job to keep the labs provided with cats. These were no lap cats. These were feral street cats, wild and mean. Even once they were caught and placed into cages, it was a challenge to anesthetize them. As all of the elements were coming together, Roger Sperry came from Caltech to visit us. He was passing through Italy and stayed with us while in Pisa. As I say, we had the benefit of a wonderful apartment with a guest room, with the only caveat that the guest bathroom's toilet ran a little too long after flushing. Roger, feeling right at home, got the necessary tools, climbed up to the ceiling, and fixed it. He was making sure we were settled in, and we all had a grand time. Finally, the big day arrived at the lab. Giovanni and Giacomo had perfected the essential operation, which some called the Encephali Soleil preparation, no slight feat in itself. This allowed the animal to be tested painlessly while awake and staring at the half-dome screen, visualizing the stimuli we projected onto it. In addition, a single electrode could be lowered into the corpus callosum, and we could eavesdrop on the neural signals that were being passed over the callosum between the hemispheres. Amid great anticipation, Giacomo slowly lowered the electrode into the callosum. As is commonly done in neurophysiology, the recording system was hooked up to a loudspeaker so that the rat-tat-tat of the neurons firing could be heard. We were ready to hear the Morse code of the brain. Then it happened. The electrode pierced the callosum. Instead of the rat-tat-tat we expected, the loudspeaker boomed with the excruciatingly clear voice of Ringo Starr singing, "We all live in a yellow submarine, a yellow submarine, a yellow submarine." Giacomo looked up from the cat and calmly said, "Now that is what I call high-order information." Some kind of electronic ground loop had been closed, and we were picking up the local radio station. We all laughed, though we knew this brain code thing was going to be a long haul. In the end, we did complete a nice piece of research. We showed how the individual neurons in the callosum coded for visual information, either to one side of the visual midline or the other. In follow-up studies over the next year, Bellucci and Rizzolatti were able to show exactly how the callosum enables the actual two halves of our visual world to seem like only one. The Nobel laureate David Hubel describes the experiment and called it the best example of exquisite neural specificity that he knew. Having cut the optic chiasm along the midline, they made recordings from Area 17, close to the 17-18 border on the right side, and looked for cells that could be driven binocularly. Obviously, any binocular cell in the visual cortex on the right side must receive input from the right eye directly, via the geniculate, and from the left eye by way of the left hemisphere and corpus callosum. Each binocular receptive field spanned the vertical midline, with the part to the left responding to the right eye and the part to the right responding to the left eye. This result showed clearly that one function of the corpus callosum is to connect cells so that their fields can span the midline. It therefore cements together the two halves of the visual world. Itching for my own laboratory. After a few months in Pisa, I was discovering that neurophysiology was not for me. It takes long hours, as all research does, but also great patience, not my strong suit. I was ready to get back and start my own academic life. I missed testing patients. I had a bunch of follow-up experiments I wanted to do, and Santa Barbara seemed a long way from Pisa. I was beginning to feel isolated and out of the loop. I wrote Kendler, the UCSB psychology chairman, and asked him if I could return early and start in January instead of July. He somehow made it work at that end, and my friend Giovanni arranged to terminate my fellowship short by 6 months in Pisa. Overall, it wasn't my finest hour, but that is what happened. The excitement of a new job, a new academic rank, a new sense of destiny, all colored my early impressions of the University of California, Santa Barbara, in 1967. It is a spectacularly beautiful setting, and the psychology department was full of talented people, including David Primack. Most of the department came out of classic experimental psychology, a whole new world to me. I was so enthusiastic that I asked Sperry if he would consider a job at Santa Barbara. It turns out that this is a fairly common pattern. Sperry actually came up and visited, and I think he even met with the chancellor, but in the end it didn't work out. What did work out was my first grant, which I had applied for before taking off for Pisa. I had written it during my last year at Caltech, and was able to have it checked by Sperry and others in the lab. It was about both animal and human work that I wanted to continue. Everyone said it was good and wished me good luck. In the 1960s, grants were fairly easy to get, and my good luck continued. Although I hadn't realized it at the time, Sperry was chair of the NIH study section that reviewed the grant. I'm sure he had to recuse himself for its evaluation, but it never hurts to have someone on the committee who is knowledgeable about the topic, even if they are standing outside the door. When I arrived at Santa Barbara, I was able to set up my monkey lab quickly and also to start testing patients again. Most psychologists don't have the luxury of testing patients whose hemispheres are disconnected, a condition that makes the examination of the separated hemispheres relatively easy. Experimental psychologists measure how long things take to do or how many errors people make when doing some kind of task. From those kinds of observations, they build a model about how such and such might work and that, indeed, there is a mental life guiding our behavior. They are really good at it, too. I was surrounded by that kind of expertise at Santa Barbara. One of the issues the early split-brain work had helped to frame was the question of how information gets integrated into the regularly intact normal brain. When we look out at the world and see a scene, each half of what we see goes to a different hemisphere. Yet to each of us, it all seems to be one unified scene with no stitching up the middle, no gap in appreciating the left side of the scene versus the right side. How does that work? Maybe all is not gapless. Maybe detectable timing differences do exist and are somehow masked? We made an early contribution to this kind of question using a very simple test. Undergraduates at Santa Barbara were brought in, and my new graduate student, Robert Philby, began testing them. Philby, with his John Lennon glasses and long curly hair, was a wonderful soul and free spirit. His roommate at Pomona College had been Larry Swanson, who went on to be one of the world's leading and most imaginative neuroanatomists. In contrast, after this experiment, Philby decided that graduate school was not for him and retreated to Garberville, California, to live life as an artist. Over the years, his drawings have graced my books, and his wit is endless. But back then, he was working hard in the lab. The task was for our volunteers to fixate on a point on a screen that was equipped with both a voice-operated relay and a simple manual electronic key. On the first set of tests, a dot flashed up on the screen, after a warning buzzer, and it appeared either to the left or right of fixation. Half of the subjects were told to say yes if a dot appeared, and no if the screen remained blank, which is to say, if nothing appeared. The other half of the subjects were told the opposite. Say yes if the screen remained blank, nothing appeared, and no if a dot appeared. The results were intriguing. When the dot came on in the left visual field, or when it was a blank trial, the verbal response, which had to come from the left hemisphere, was 30 milliseconds slower than when the dot was presented in the right visual field. Thus it appeared that when the dot was initially projected to the left speaking hemisphere from the right visual field, the overall response was much faster. But when there was a blank trial in the left visual field, the response was slower because, after all, the fact that nothing was presented had to be deduced by the left speaking hemisphere, and the left hemisphere must have been waiting for the right hemisphere to report in, and that took time. Still, this lengthy response time, 30 milliseconds, didn't make any sense. We knew from physiological studies that it should take only 0.5 milliseconds for a nerve to conduct a message across the callosum. Why were our behavioral measures so slow? And if they were that slow, why didn't we sense it in some way in our own experience? We did one more run at it. Instead of requesting our undergraduates to say yes or no to the flash dots and blanks, we instructed them to respond with their right hand on a lever that was to be pushed one way for a yes response and the other way for a no response. Changing the experiment in this way might reveal that we were not dealing with a transfer time from one hemisphere to the other, but with the simple fact that the right hemisphere was slower than the left when asked to respond to even simple tasks. Well, the undergraduates gave a clear answer to the experiment, which continues to puzzle researchers to this day. The manual response to a dot was equally fast when the right hand was responding, no matter in which visual field it appeared. This suggested that each hemisphere could organize a motor response equally fast. What was surprising, however, was that it took 40 milliseconds longer for the hand to respond to a blank trial. Wherever in the brain the decision to respond was being made, it took longer for both hemispheres to report that a blank trial had occurred. Perhaps it took longer for a brain to decide that nothing had happened than that something had. Maybe we were not getting at the crux of the matter after all. That happens in science. It happens most of the time. Thankfully, others have worked on this problem and made real progress. In fact, an entire Italian research team worked on it, led by Bellucci. Indeed, we continue to work on the problem of how the two half-brains coordinate their activity and functions. While it seems on the surface to be a split-brain-specific issue, it is really dealing with one of the central issues in brain research. How do parts of the brain interact with other parts? As the late comedian Henny Youngman would say, timing is everything. In the brain, usually the parts are only a few microns away from each other, or a few centimeters. In both cases, local processes have to conduct their business and then either send or somehow coordinate the information with another part of the brain. Asking how this works between the hemispheres gives the researcher a bit of breathing room, as the physical distances between processing sites are very far apart. David Premack and his 40-year-old question. In Santa Barbara, many new lines of research were born and more lifelong friendships were established. One of my closest lifelong friendships has been with David Premack, and it began there. It is difficult to think of a living psychologist more influential than he has been. When we consider our origins, our history, our uniqueness as humans, it is Premack who has been our best guide in the understanding of who we are. As Liz Spelke, the distinguished Harvard psychologist, once told me, "Oh, Dave discovered everything first." Before his pioneering work on the cognitive and the possible language capacities of the chimpanzee, Dave made fundamental insights into the nature of motivation. Behaviorism had developed the view that animals were motivated by external contingencies, a view that failed to consider that animals might have internal states and preferences. He turned the entire view about the nature of reinforcement on its ear by looking beyond what was easily observable. Using the methods of science, he unearthed the underlying principles of what motivates living creatures to act. He tested these principles by challenging the minds of chimps and, in particular, a chimp named Sarah. I know, since she lived down the hall from my office for years. I don't care for chimpanzees. I've always found them too aggressive and bestial and, quite frankly, would walk in the other direction when Sarah approached with her trainer, Mary, or with David. Even so, Sarah was no ordinary chimp. She was exceptionally smart and engaging. She was also volatile. Dave perfectly managed her by being even more unpredictable and clever than she had ever seen a human be. This was one Homo sapiens who always beat her at her own game. David established a social relationship with her, and then began to use it to explore exactly what was and was not in and on Sarah's mind. At that time, Dave was beginning to clarify the intellectual limits of our closest living relative, and in doing so, he began to unearth the factors that make humans unique. Premack's work did not go unnoticed by the University of Pennsylvania. Before I knew it, David and his wife Anne were on a plane with Sarah, headed to Honeybrook, Pennsylvania. A chimp facility was being specially built in Amish country to house the chimps for his research. It was there, with the help of Sarah and a small group of young chimps, that Dave gave birth to the idea of theory of mind, one of the major ideas of 20th century psychology. TOM, Tom, as it is called, reflects the ability of one's mind to attribute mental states, such as beliefs and desires, not only to oneself, I believe cats are devious, but to others, he wants to get a dog, so we may have a theory about what a chimp and our dog believe and desire. I think that Fido wants to play ball. But do a chimp and a dog have a theory about our beliefs and desires? Does Fido think for a moment that I am sick of throwing the ball? Does the chimp have a theory about other chimps? Does it understand that others have thoughts, beliefs, and desires, and some primitive understanding of what they themselves are? As in all breakthroughs, it is the ingenuity of the question that makes the impact. This is another Premack specialty. Dave has the rare ability to turn an issue on its ear. The question of whether or not an animal could have a theory about humans or anything else did exactly that. He changed our perspective and opened up a wealth of research on animals, children, and various neurologic syndromes. While an argument rages on in the animal research literature about the capacity of chimps, or orangutans, or dogs for that matter, it is clear they don't have much theory of mind, and certainly not to the degree that humans do. It should come as no surprise, therefore, that this question would have a huge effect on me and how I was to think about issues in the next phase of my own work. Picnicking with Steve Allen. One dimension of working for a university that is missing from a medical school, or a place like Caltech, is that one has the duty to teach undergraduates. Some people thrive on these assignments and are truly brilliant at the task. Some are not drawn to it and are uninspiring. Still others find it takes too much time away from their research. I fit into the latter category. It is true that by teaching, one comes to understand a topic more deeply, especially topics about which one has only a passing interest, but when one is committed to a particular area of research, most topics are of that kind. Once I was established as an assistant professor, I had Psychology One duty, introductory psychology. Almost 1,000 students showed up 3 times a week for class at the university's largest auditorium, Campbell Hall. A bit of crowd control and mass motivation are required when the numbers are this big. In short, one has to keep the students interested and motivated and entertained. Doing it 3 times a week was grueling. Like everyone I know who teaches these large courses, one seeks some kind of relief. Movies, guest lecturers, and more. I had an idea to have a guest lecturer to beat all guest lecturers. My new best friend, Steve Allen. So I called Steve and asked if he would like to come up and give a lecture, gratis. He accepted in a flash. The lecture was at 8 a.m., so he drove up the night before, stayed at a motel near the university, and showed up bright and early. We had agreed he should talk about the creative process. Steve was a man of many talents, songwriting being one of them. Sitting at the piano I had moved into the lecture hall, he told the story of what was behind his greatest hit, Picnic, the theme song from the movie of the same name. Steve had written the lyrics in record time after receiving a call from the producer. As he looked back on it, he basically came up with what a psychologist would call a resource allocation model for creativity. Usually, he said, he would be asked to write a song with absolutely no constraints put on the assignment. For the song Picnic, however, the producer said, "I want you to write the lyrics to the theme for our movie, which stars William Holden and Kim Novak, and they will be dancing at a picnic." As Steve pointed out, all his energies became focused on the task at hand, and it was quickly accomplished. In contrast, in the unconstrained situation, so much energy is lost trying to define the context and idea for a song, one is depleted by the time the actual task is underway. It is much more effortful and takes longer. While the visit was a terrific success, it underscores how complex life as a teacher and researcher truly is on a day-to-day basis. Preparing for a lecture, if it is to be any good, takes time. Doing good research takes time. The two enterprises invariably clash. Sperry used to complain about it and always told the story about what Carl Ashley, one of his famous mentors, had told him during his postdoctoral years at Harvard. "Don't teach, but if you have to teach, teach neuroanatomy. It never changes." Of course, there are some colleagues who possess incredible verbal memories and have an easy verbal fluency that finds them talking all the time. Teaching is no big deal for such people, because the entire day is one big verbal flow, interrupted by demarcations of time called class. It is easy for them. For others, it is a challenge. To this day, I find teaching grueling. A few years ago, when I was asked to prepare 6 consecutive lectures for the Gifford Lecture Series at the University of Edinburgh, I worked for 2 years to get them ready. How did I ever do 3 a week? Sharing resources, the heart of science. On the scientific side of the Santa Barbara Ledger, I received a call one day from a graduate student at Berkeley who wanted to test a split-brain patient on a visual task. Little did I realize it would turn into another lifelong friendship and instigate a new tradition in the lab. The student was Colin Blakemore, now professor of neuroscience at Oxford, as well as at University College London. He and another student had an idea about seeing depth at the visual midline. I invited him down to Santa Barbara, where he set up his gear and tested NG. This is how it goes in science. A story gets going on how things work. Slowly, with lots of people contributing, it gets added to, bit by bit. In this case, Mitchell and Blakemore showed how important cortical connections were to the integration of information isolated in each hemisphere that was responsible for seeing depth at the center of the human gaze. Our early reports on WJ were being expanded upon, while also illuminating an observation of crucial interest to the specialized field of visual science. The importance of pathways, of discrete neural fiber systems for transferring information around the human brain, had begun to develop. This very positive experience inaugurated what became a long tradition of bringing outside scientists to our labs. Split-brain patients were a precious resource for understanding brain mechanisms. While surgical medicine was helping people's lives, we were helping people in a different way, by trying to understand how the human brain worked. Clearly, we didn't have all the good ideas. The Mitchell and Blakemore studies became classic. It is the duty of scientists to facilitate good science. I continued to work out more details of how one hemisphere could control the ipsilateral hand. Moving from ideas generated by the human work, I could test specific mechanisms in the monkey and vice versa. By the time I had left Caltech, it had been fairly well established that cross-cueing was a powerful mechanism. Tests on split-brain monkeys and human patients made it clear that cross-cueing strategies could overcome elimination of the major neural communication pathway between the two hemispheres. It is the neurobiologic equivalent of people of whom it is said, and it is said of me, if you throw him out the front door, he will come back in through the window. During the Santa Barbara years, several more studies on monkeys and the patients confirmed this important idea. Block any way the brain communicates with its modules, and it will most likely find another strategy to achieve the goal at hand. Life was good. Then, suddenly, I was asked by the senior leadership in the department if I would serve as chair. What? I exclaimed. Yes, they all said. We have promoted you to tenure and associate professor after only 2 years on the faculty. They told me Sperry and other Caltech faculty, such as James Bonner, had written me grand letters, and UCSB had approved the departmental request. I was enthusiastically encouraged to take on the task by all the elements of the department, and in fact was wooed into accepting the job. Now that I was tenured, I had to do my share of administrative work. Robert Zients, the late distinguished social psychologist at the University of Michigan, once told me that he had successfully avoided administration for 30 years. Finally, out of some sense of gratitude, he took over as director of the Institute for Social Research. Mike, he said, it is amazing how right in front of your eyes, friends you have had for 30 years become assholes. He nailed it, and it certainly was true at Santa Barbara. Senior friends of mine would come into the chair's office, close the door, and start twisting my arm for this or that. In many ways, it was hilarious, and is made even more so with the distance of time. Of course, on the fun side, when one takes those positions, little pots of money can be found and applied to good academic causes. I found some funds and arranged to hire Donald M. McKay, the distinguished neurophysiologist, physicist, and student of the mind-brain problem. His home base was the University of Kiel in the United Kingdom, and he was extremely popular with the American neuroscience community. He had written widely on a model of the brain that suggested that even though the brain was as mechanical as clockwork, as he put it, there was still free will. He and Sperry had a running but cordial argument about the issue. At any rate, I brought him out to UCSB for a few months. It is hard for me to lavish enough personal praise on Donald and his wife Valerie as well. We rented a house for him and his family on a sunny hillside that was equipped with a glistening swimming pool. Our families would meet there for barbecues, and one day in particular, Valerie noticed my oldest daughter, Marin, was at the bottom of the pool. Thankfully, Valerie saw her and jumped in and basically saved her life. Accidents happen in a flash, and since then, I have become vigilant whenever kids are around. When one goes to the extra effort to create a more interesting intellectual community than the status quo, one wonders if it is worth it. Convincing people to think about matters outside their specific interests is a battle and always has been. Fortunately, people who enjoy doing this tend to find each other. To my enormous surprise, the McKay Lecture Series brought up to UCSB a young philosopher from the University of California, Irvine, Daniel Dennett, who has become one of the world's great intellectuals. Dan's lifelong interest in free will surely was encouraged by those talks. He drove up for the lectures and, as it turned out, we too have become lifelong friends. All of these seeds count, and they all add up. 50 years later, I gave a talk at the Vatican on the subject of free will, and it featured the work of McKay, Dennett, and Sperry. Feeling my oats and finding other funds to spend, I brought in other famous neuroscientists, such as Brenda Milner from Montreal, who was the first to study HM, the most famous memory patient in cognitive neuroscience, and Hans-Lucas Tuber, the charismatic head of brain research at MIT and the founder of its brain and cognitive sciences department. Linda and I had moved from the tract house that Cliff Morgan helped us to buy to a new redwood house on Mission Creek. It was unfinished but gorgeous when we bought it, and we finished it ourselves, calling upon family and friends for help in design and construction. It turned out to be a magnificent treehouse sort of thing, with vaulted ceilings surrounded by fresh redwood paneling, brick, rock, and glass. It was the perfect house for parties and parties we gave. One of the first was for Tuber. Being the natural pedagogue that he was, he took me into my bedroom, sat me down on our bed, whipped out a manuscript I had submitted to the journal he had helped start, and gave me a lesson in editing. Hearing the clinking of glasses out in the living room along with much laughter, I remember thinking to myself, I thought I worked hard. I am punk. In June 1968, Robert Kennedy was assassinated in Los Angeles. I was taking a shower in the unfinished part of our house, and my wife ran in very upset and agitated with the news. Her command was, you have to do something. Having met RFK a few years earlier at Caltech, I found this news especially wrenching. I quickly realized I could do something, and sure enough those extra funds were helpful once again. I put together a quick meeting on the nature of violence, calling upon some new friends and some old friends. I called Leon Festinger, my budding new friend. He called his best friend, Stanley Schachter at Columbia, and Ken Colby at Stanford. They called their friend Paul Meal at the University of Minnesota, who agreed to come because their friend and former student, Dave Primack, my colleague, would be there too. I also called Bob Sinsheimer, who was chair of biology at Caltech. While there was some ribbing about Leon engineering a meeting at my expense to see his old friends, the event itself probably hooked me on the value of getting smart people in one space and letting them chew on almost any topic. I didn't realize it at the time, but I was putting together my first interdisciplinary forum. Seeing a truly distinguished molecular biologist, Sinsheimer, and the whiz computer scientist Colby, who was also a psychiatrist, discuss societal issues of violence with social psychologists, changed the game for me. Not only did it reveal a new level of conversation that I loved and have sought ever since, and from which I learned that it is only the really smart people who let everything be put on the table, but it also revealed how productive interdisciplinary discussions can be. My interest in public affairs continued to grow. In the spring of 1969, I wrote an op-ed for the Los Angeles Times on the problem of crime prevention. The Santa Barbara meeting on violence had pulled together some telling points that seemed to be worth repeating to the public. Stan Schachter had reminded the group that roughly 60% of felons returned to crime after serving in prison. Nothing seemed to change that number. David Primack had reminded us about the nature of reinforcement and punishment. These were not discrete categories. They were on a continuum. One man's punishment may not be another's. Did the 60% who returned to prison not find the experience so aversive? The trick would be to find a punishment that worked for each individual person. When you think about this scheme, it is value-free. Look at a group of 1,000 people. Some start to engage in antisocial behavior. The goal to constrain them should not have at its core the idea of retribution and justice. The goal should be to pick a punishment that reduces the frequency of the antisocial behavior. It's a big idea that, to this day, continues to be battled over in the legal and scientific community. The op-ed piece caught the eye of none other than the former governor of California, Pat Brown. Soon I was dining with him at the Beverly Hills Hotel, which was next to his Los Angeles law offices. He invited me down to discuss the whole idea, and by the end of the lunch had asked me to take over a floundering book project he had launched with his ex-press agent. The book was all about law and order, and Pat's historic role in those issues as district attorney, Attorney General, and then Governor of California. As I took on Pat's book project, the winds of change once again began blowing my way. Footnote. I did finish the book to Pat's satisfaction, and to the publisher's, but not to that of Jerry Brown, his son, then just starting his climb to the governorship he'd win 6 years later. The odd thing about this project is that while it was concluded 43 years ago, only 6 months ago, a total stranger wrote to me to ask if an old manuscript that he had found was in fact the very same book. Indeed it was. As I reread it, it was chilling to see how little my view, then placed in the governor's first-person narrative, has changed even after recently working for 4 years on a $10 million MacArthur Foundation project dealing with the same issues. Part 2. Hemispheres Together and Apart. Chapter 4. Unmasking More Modules. What is a friend? A single soul dwelling in two bodies. Aristotle. It was still early days in the world of split-brain research. The basic findings were now well reported, and the early buzz was that, following a relatively simple neurosurgical procedure, two minds, each with its own set of controls, could exist in one brain. The traumatic disconnection effects had held up for years. Activities isolated to the right hemisphere were unquestionably independent and outside the realm of awareness of the left hemisphere. Clear, clean, and simple. It was the talk of cocktail parties around the world. Looking back with the benefit of time, the curse of present knowledge rears its head. We all know about left-brain, right-brain thinking. We are almost bored with it, just as we become bored with often-played tunes. What gets lost is that, at the time, it was a huge deal, in large part because of the then-current revolution in psychology. The ideological backbone of American psychology, behaviorism, was dying a slow death. And intellectual centers across the country, from Harvard to Caltech, were waking up to the fact that cognition and the mind itself could be studied. Behind much of this thinking was Lashley and his stance that mental properties could be studied by examining the neurophysiological processes of the brain. He adopted the term neuropsychology, which in his day meant the brain processes of the normal brain rather than the dysfunction of the brain due to lesions or injury. Ironically, he liked Acolytus's finding that cutting the callosum seemingly did nothing to disrupt the brain because, in Lashley's view, it was the whole brain that created the mind, not particular parts. Even though he helped launch the modern fields of psychobiology and neuroscience, which are dominant fields today, he would have been stunned with the basic split-brain findings of two minds in one head. There was no getting around it. The new work on split-brain humans was haunting. Our most precious sense of life is our very own private subjective experience, that feeling of my mind, which is what we all mean when we think about minds. We all think we each have one, and I mean one. To suddenly think it can be divided, that two minds are coexisting in one cranium, is almost not comprehensible. To think W.J. had two minds gazing out at the world, two listening and two thinking about others, indeed, too thinking about me, was unsettling. The uneasiness we feel about the idea of having two or even multiple subjective states may well have been what led us to our discovery years later of the interpreter, the special device in our left brain that gives our actions one narrative and the sense that we have but one mind. It was also clear that the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere did different things. The left hemisphere was chock full of speech and language processes. While the right seemed mute and language impoverished, it was able to do some fancy visual tasks. Those findings gave birth to mind-left and mind-right thinking. And suddenly, everybody was a neurologist at those cocktail parties. And again, it was simple. The left did this, and the right did that. The brain seemed simple, and organized in big functional units that were managed by specific regions of itself. The idea took off like wildfire. By 1969, it was also clear that the two half-brains could develop clever ways to interact, making it look like the hemispheres were not disconnected at all. The brain was like an old couple who had lived together for years and finally worked out a way to live together yet be separate. This made it difficult to do the research. We wanted to understand how the brain was truly organized, not just how it had figured out behavioral strategies for seeming connected and integrated. At the same time, it was becoming apparent to me that it was in those strategies that we would learn something basic about how the brain was organized. It was the brain's catch-22. We had to be as wily as the brains we were studying. It forced us to be constantly vigilant for its tricks and to continually think up new ways to investigate the patients. It was during this time that the simple descriptions of brain function were beginning to lose their appeal to me. If the right brain was a separate mental system with at least some language, why didn't people who suffered aphasia following left brain damage recover more readily and easily? In short, why didn't mind right cover for mind left, just like the left or right kidney covers for the other if damaged? I knew that if I was going to make any headway on this question, I needed to start being associated with a medical center that saw a wide range of neurological patients. Stepping onto the next lily pad in life is always hard, especially when the current one is holding up just fine. The tug of war between taking risks to do something new and staying with the tried and true seemed ever-present. While I think all of us usually prime ourselves for new possibilities, it is others who bring them to us. In the midst of all this work and rumination, I had been offered a job at New York University. East Coast Fever. One sunny spring morning in Santa Barbara, I was sitting with Leon Festinger on my redwood deck, surrounded by oak trees and boulders, soaking up the beauty of Mission Canyon. Leon, who had just decided to move to New York City, said to me, "You know, people feel differently about living in New York. Some think it is like Paris, and others think it is like hell." Unable to contain myself while he went on about New York, I said, "But Leon, what do you think of this house?" He looked around, noting all the fine woodworking, the lofty ceilings, the stone fireplace, the magnificent setting, and said, "Well, if you wanted this sort of thing in Manhattan, it would cost millions of dollars." Somehow, between his wit and his flattering interest in me, he managed to set the hook. I thought to myself, he takes risks. He is moving from Stanford to the New School for Social Research. So why can't I? It was time to go east to escape the clutches of Southern California. Leon was the draw. New York was the unknown, and what the future would bring was anybody's guess. Sperry had made it increasingly clear through various surrogates that he didn't want me testing the Caltech patients anymore. While unhappy about that, I understood, in a way. He was kicking me out of the extended nest and letting others have their day. In the end, I thought that was reasonable, and away we went. We sold my Redwood Palace, packed up, and moved to New York. Festinger was the intellectually intense discoverer of cognitive dissonance, the idea that when a personal belief is challenged by new information, we tend to ignore the new information in order to reduce mental conflict. Leon and I had taken an instant liking to one another a year earlier at his home in Palo Alto, where he held his Stanford graduate seminars. He'd called out of the blue and wanted to know about my research. That meant I would give a talk to him and his class, which he always held in his living room. Leon stuck me in a chair at the front of his living room, sat right next to me, chain-smoking his ever-present Camels, and started to query me on each point of my research. When Leon moved into a new field, he wanted to know everything in detail. He was a fearless explorer of new intellectual territory. In the years that followed, he switched again to the field of archaeology and prehistory. At the time of his death, he was working on the impact of the introduction of technology on medieval societies. I was right behind him on all of these topics, always amazed at his erudition and energy. It was like having your own personal scholar opening for you vast horizons for thought and analysis. It would be difficult to imagine two more different people. We had different philosophies, different styles, different aspirations, and we're of different generations. Our enduring friendship developed around a mutual love for good ideas, good food and drink, and lively conversation. Once we both moved east, we were surrounded by the magic of New York, which included the elan of scientists like Festinger and my political buddy Buckley. With these intellectual giants, everything was always on the table. Parochialism and simplistic zealotry were to be checked at the door. When it wasn't, my eyes learned to glaze over. As Walt Whitman observed, Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime. My move to New York was part pull and part push. The pull was easy to identify. The new school for social research was an unlikely place for Leon to go, given his new intellectual move from the field of social psychology to that of visual perception. He quickly formed a front group, fondly called the Inter-University Consortium on Perception, an administrative device to have his friends from Columbia, New York University, and the City College of New York meet to discuss issues in the area of visual perception, and of course to also meet and have drinks. NYU recruited me in the eventful spring of 1968. While in the office of a future colleague at NYU, I remember hearing on the radio that Martin Luther King had just been assassinated. Vietnam was a big issue, and New York was buzzing. Before I knew it, I was part of that buzz. I had moved my family to the Silver Towers at NYU. Out of our 26th-floor apartment, we watched the World Trade Center being built. My resistance to life in New York was less tangible. For almost 8 years, I had lived with an identity, that of being completely immersed in human split-brain research. I had been heavily involved for the first 5 years in virtually all of the experiments, all day, every day. I had written up the work in review articles, and was also putting the finishing touches on my first book, The Bisected Brain, which Arnold Toe, from the University of Washington, had invited me to write. Still, relinquishing what I knew to be a vibrant way to approach understanding the brain was tough. While the cues were loud and clear, the path forward was not. I mean, really, New York City? Being raised in Glendale, California, a place Evelyn Waugh called Home of Forest Lawn, the Disneyland of Death, followed by 4 years in the boonies of Hanover, New Hampshire, followed by 5 years in Pasadena, and finally 3 years in Santa Barbara, did not necessarily prepare one for New York City. When we arrived from California, it was a boiling hot 94-degree August day, complete with humidity, traffic jams, and the local tourist attraction, rudeness. I muttered to myself, "Welcome to New York, sucker, you really blew it," and it only seemed to get worse. We found a small Catholic school, St. Joseph's Academy for my daughter Marin, in Washington Square. I can remember picking our way around street bums as we walked to school every morning. One goes from indifference to social surroundings to vigilance. The saving grace of it all was that my daughter didn't seem the least bit concerned, nor was her younger sister Anne back at the play yard at the Towers, where various reprobates regularly came to relieve themselves. The New York mothers simply moved their bassinets and looked the other way. So long as my daughters shared punching the elevator buttons at the end of the day, all seemed well. We grew to love the city, and I spent the next 17 years living either in Manhattan or in the suburbs. Joan Didion once wrote, though, that no Californian ever unpacks their bags when moving to New York, even though many wind up staying there for decades. It certainly played out that way for me. The New York Lunch. Any kind of sequence in life appears less like a linear narrative and more like what happens when you beat up batter for Yorkshire pudding. In the pudding, there are lots of little bubbles that combine to make bigger bubbles in the sticky goo and grow until the bubble pops, when, of course, it starts all over again. One might work away at something, and then something unrelated might interrupt that work. Or someone enters your life with a whole new set of ideas that set you on a different course. Our brains yearn for interruptions, even though we are annoyed when someone interrupts us. As we all surely know, life is not a sustained upward climb, where everything and everybody only gets better. After hearing multiple older professors say they were now doing their best work ever, a statistician friend asked me, how could that be? He found it funny that people actually think that way. The fact is, life's successes and failures are sporadic, and their causes are difficult to determine. Hard work and luck are behind most successes, though it is hard to say, for any given success, how much of each there has been. Still, we develop an overarching narrative about ourselves and about the issues we study. The narrative keeps us bounded. It allows us to avoid becoming dilettantes. We learn to know and loathe bullshit when we hear it. Being part of the one-brain, two-mind story has been life-defining for me. But in 1969, and for the prior 3 years at UCSB, I had been listening to talk about motivation and reinforcement and dozens of other psychological concepts that had not been discussed much at Caltech. Apparently, they had seeped in, and as I hit the deck at NYU, I began research on brain mechanisms underlying reinforcement on rats, as well as on split-brain monkeys. No one paid much attention to the work, but I thought it was pretty cool. I was broadening my intellectual interests and no longer singing only one note about split-brain research. Starting new work on neurological patients would have to wait. So while I was launching the new scientific work at NYU, the real continuity in my life was provided by Leon and our weekly lunch, which became a 20-year tradition. We usually ate at a small Italian restaurant on 12th Street in University Place, Il Bambino. You could get a couple of martinis and shrimp scampi for about $10. Or we ate at Dardanelles, the landmark Armenian restaurant just down University Place before 11th Street. The drill was always the same. A couple of drinks, a great meal, and always, always lively conversation with one of the smartest men in the world. While noonday martinis are out of favor, once a year my wife Charlotte, whom I married after Linda and I parted a few years after moving east, and I go out and give it a whirl for old time's sake. Needless to say, we are out of practice and nap immediately afterward. Unbeknownst to me at the time, Leon used to go back and also take a nap, while I went back to work chewing mints. Leon taught me what friendship means. I have written elsewhere about what it was like to know him, and will only reiterate here a small part of it. Once consumed with the desire to understand an issue, Leon couldn't divert his attention from it, and somehow nothing else seemed important in comparison. It wasn't that he wasn't aware of his surroundings. After all, New York was his Paris. But none of that mattered when he pursued an idea. I know this because early in his career he had left New York for Iowa City, Iowa, to study with Kurt Lewin, and New Yorkers don't move to Iowa lightly. Lewin was a commanding figure in psychology, and to hear Leon tell it was adept at generating new frameworks for studying psychological mechanisms. Leon had read Lewin as an undergraduate and was drawn to his ideas. The great philosopher R.G. Collingwood noted in his autobiography that as a very young man he had stumbled upon the work of Kant. Though he couldn't quite say why, Collingwood sensed that the work was important. For the undergraduate Leon, it was Lewin's work that was so intriguing. He was fascinated by the idea that events could be better remembered if interrupted in their execution. Lewin's research, prior to Leon's arrival in Iowa, had laid the groundwork for the ultimate rejection of the classic laws of associationism, the belief that mental life resulted from the simple associations of events and experiences, an idea with tremendous surface validity. By the time Leon moved to Iowa, Lewin's interests had begun to shift toward social psychology. So did Leon's during their years of collaboration, even though neither of them had ever received formal training in that area. You want to learn something? Go learn it. The bright, creative mind doesn't need a training program. Announcing that he was now a social psychologist, Lewin took a position at MIT and started the Center for Group Dynamics, which Leon joined. He became interested in the behavior of small groups. Most important, his new group at MIT had developed ways to study complex human decision-making in the laboratory. Lewin, Festinger, and many others migrated out of the dust bowl of empiricism to the east to test their hypothesis that private mental states were influenced by group dynamics, the special behaviors that arise both within groups and between groups. Leon's most famous work started with a small grant from the Ford Foundation to study and integrate the work in mass media and interpersonal communication. He and his colleagues took on the project, and to hear him tell it, the seminal observation came from considering a 1934 report about an Indian earthquake. The fact that puzzled them was that after the earthquake, the vast majority of the rumors that were circulated predicted that an even worse one was coming. Why, after such a horrendous event, would people want to provoke further anxiety? Leon and his colleagues concluded that it was a coping mechanism that the Indian people had developed to deal with their present anxiety. In other words, since the earthquake had filled the population with grief, they had formulated an even greater future tragedy, which cast the present moment in a better light. It was out of this basic observation that the theory of cognitive dissonance was born. It would take 7 years of hard work to nail down all of the parameters of the phenomenon, but nail them down he did. Leon carried out one of his early experiments with his two close friends, Stanley Schachter and Henry Reichen. Although a real group of people had been studied, He chronicled the story with a fictitious character in place. As the story goes, the group had come to believe the flood prophecy of one Mrs. Marion Keach. Months before the day of the flood, the following headline and news report had appeared in the Lake City Herald. Prophecy from Planet Clarion. Call to city. Flee that flood. It'll swamp us on December 21, Outer Space tells Suburbanite. Lake City will be destroyed by a flood from the Great Lake just before dawn, December 21, according to a suburban housewife. Mrs. Marion Keach of 847 West School Street says the prophecy is not her own. It is the purport of many messages she has received by automatic writing, she says. The messages, according to Mrs. Keach, are sent to her by superior beings from a planet called Clarion. These beings have been visiting the Earth, she says, in what we call flying saucers. During their visits, she says they have observed fault lines in the Earth's crust that foretoken the deluge. Mrs. Keach reports she was told the flood will spread to form an inland sea stretching from the Arctic Circle to the Gulf of Mexico. At the same time, she says a cataclysm will submerge the west coast from Seattle, Washington, to Chile and South America. Now, your ordinary scientist might have stayed as far away from this as possible. I mean, really, this is National Enquirer stuff, and potentially hazardous to one's career. Well, not Leon. He and a team went to Lake City forthwith, where Mrs. Keach received another message. On December 20, an extraterrestrial visitor was to appear at her house around midnight to escort her and her followers to a parked flying saucer and take them away from the flood, presumably to outer space. Leon's prediction, assuming that the momentous event did not occur, was that the followers would attempt to reduce their dissonant state, produced by not having their beliefs confirmed, by attempting to convince others of those beliefs. A vast set of experimental data now supports that view, but at the time it was brand new. The clock struck 12 in Lake City. The group waited. No alien visitor arrived to take them to a flying saucer. An awkward period began among the believers waiting in Mrs. Keach's living room. But a few hours later, Mrs. Keach received another message. For this day, it is established that there is but one God of Earth, and he is in our midst, and from his hand thou hast written these words. And mighty is the word of God, and by his word have ye been saved. For from the mouth of death have ye been delivered, and at no time has there been such a force loosed upon the earth. Not since the beginning of time upon this earth has there been such a force of good and light as now floods this room, and that which has been loosed within this room now floods the entire earth. As thy God has spoken through the two who sit within these walls, has he manifested that which he has given thee to do. Suddenly the room was in better shape, and Mrs. Keach reached for the phone to call the press. She had never done this before, but now she felt that she must, and soon all the members of the group had called various branches of the news media. For days this sort of justification went on, and Leon's prediction was spellbindingly confirmed. All of this came from a man who loved to play backgammon for hours on end. Unlike many academics, who talk a great deal without listening, Leon was a conversationalist. That back and forth reinforced his game behavior. Like all the truly great intellects I have known, he both listened and elicited testimony from the speaker. Being lectured to or lecturing himself turned him off. In the long run, what was so captivating for me was experiencing his insistence on avoiding the trap we all fall into, being transfixed by simple correlations and conclusions. He always dug below the surface. The eloquence of cognitive dissonance theory surely guided me toward my ideas on brain modularity and belief formation, which I wrote about in The Social Brain many years later. Those priceless lunches and road trips to faraway places, including archaeological digs, all taught me about the richness of psychological concepts and provoked my thinking. My life was changed forever by knowing Leon. It was the scope and intellectual energy he brought to everything, from potato pancake recipes to complex mathematical formulations about brain scan data. His canvas had no boundaries, nor did his friendship. I had never experienced anything like it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.